Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. I'm taking a rare week off, and I'm re-presenting an installment from January 2010. It's called Cheap Junk and the Deindustrialization of America. I think it's a good one, and I hope you will too. Enjoy! I was going to start by asking if Andy Rooney were still alive. Then I felt guilty and spent the 10 seconds it took to look up Rooney on Google. Apparently he's still alive. Some of you may be delighted to hear that. Each to his own taste, I guess. As I keep proclaiming, I haven't watched television for 11 or 12 years. But memories of that right-wing clown on 60 Minutes still leave a bad taste in my mouth. Like Rooney, I'm going to start grousing about a pet peeve. Unlike Rooney, I'm not going to adamantly refuse to suggest that there's any connection between the peeve and the larger forces that are destroying our world, notably American-style transnational corporate capitalism and their water carriers at every level of government. Rooney's the sort of guy who would boldly take on, say, the insurance industry, fearlessly criticizing them for printing their policies in type just a little too small to read comfortably. That's courage, Andy. Next thing, he'll fearlessly criticize Hitler for being too dull and conservative in his wardrobe. Brown, brown, brown! Who does Hitler think he is, the UPS man? Konrad Adenauer, Chancellor of West Germany after the war, reportedly had a bon mot on Hitler's wardrobe. As I remember it, Adenauer was visiting a historical museum somewhere, and the curator explained to him that General Napoleon Bonaparte favored red uniforms, so that if he were wounded below the neck by bullet or shell, his troops would not panic at the sight of the great leader looking all covered in blood. Adenauer replied, "Now I know why Hitler always wore brown." That line is almost as funny as W. Bush's, "I know how hard it is to put food on your family." Especially in my house, where my 12-year-old is more nimble than I, and quite accomplished at ducking the produce I hurl at him. But, as Groucho Marx noted, you can dodge a flying tomato, but you can't duck soup. And, if you recall, the wonderful comic movie of that name ends with a glorious food fight. But to return to madness, my gripe du jour is about cheap junk. Here, cheap means mostly shoddy, though cheap often describes the retail price as well. Let me give you an example of the opposite. I've always cooked most of the dinners in my family. To do that, I need good tools. I have one in my hand now. It's a classic 5-inch stainless steel kitchen knife. It has a full tang, and it's forged rather than stamped. Two tough plastic hand grips are bolted to the two sides of the tang. Between the rear of the blade and your index finger, the metal gracefully swells to a sort of cylinder that mates perfectly with the plastic handle pieces. No gap anywhere between plastic and metal, every curve rounded and smoothed. Not a rough spot anywhere, not a sharp edge anywhere, except of course where you want one, on the blade. The knife fits in my hand perfectly, and it feels beautifully balanced. The steel sharpens easily and holds a good edge for a fair amount of time. It is now my favorite knife, and if it were the only kitchen knife I owned, I would be inconvenienced very little. It bears the brand name of a respected American knife maker. By now, alas, probably only a respected American knife marketing company. I bought it about 2 years ago at a store that buys and sells manufacturers' odd lots. It's made in China, and I spent all of $4 for it, and I confess to feeling a little ambivalent towards it. I focus on this wonderful piece of cutlery because it is the exception that proves the rule. Incidentally, proves means tests here. The knife is the exception that proves several rules. In a household that contains its share of cheap junk, this knife is a rebuke to all concerned, including the idiot that purchased much of that cheap junk. I won't mention any names, but it's me. Here's one thing the knife proves. China today can manufacture superb quality products when American marketing types hire them to. If the last 12 Chinese products you purchased are cheap junk, the reason is that American capitalists have decided to compete with each other only on price. They pay their overseas suppliers as little as they possibly can and willingly accept the inevitable result: goods poorly made out of inferior materials, which they can sell for a fairly low price while making a large profit margin. The practice inevitably causes terrible exploitation of workers abroad, terrible pollution of the environment abroad, destruction of forests, jungles, and farmlands abroad, and growing unemployment and poverty at home. 10,000 kitchen knives made in China are 10,000 kitchen knives no longer made in Chicago, are 50 skilled machinists now unemployed, or at best being exploited, now working for a pittance without benefits at Walmart or McDonald's. This is not coming off the top of my head, by the way. I'm summarizing several of the main points of journalism professor Ellen Ruppel-Shell in her recent book, Cheap: The High Price of Discount Culture. We'll hear more on these subjects from other people soon, but first, let me get back to my Andy Rooney impersonation. I just threw out my first MP3 player after about 1 year of use. The multifunction switch never worked reliably. At last, it stopped working entirely. Most of my modest Cape Cod-style house is around 75 years old, but there's an added family room, so-called, that's only about 20 years. All of the doorknobs in the new room have failed or are failing, including the name brand lock set in one of the exterior doors. The old part of the house is doing fine. A few years ago, I bought two kitchen devices with respected American brand names, a Farberware corkscrew and a Revereware stainless steel saucepan. Both were so crappy I returned them. The bottom of the saucepan was so rounded you couldn't use it on an electric stove. Turns out the corporation that owns Farberware and the corporation that owns Revereware simply sold U.S. rights to the brand name to obscure manufacturers in Asia. And their U.S. distributors told the manufacturers to stamp the brand name on products made as cheaply as possible. Last I looked, Revereware pots are junk from Malaysia. I still have a couple of old ones that were well made in New York State. Now, Malaysia has an advanced industrial sector. They design and manufacture well-regarded internal combustion engines. Malaysia is more than capable of making a good stainless steel pot, though it might cost their American distributor an extra 20 cents on their $20 pot. Forget it, say the Americans. We'll make 20 cents more profit per unit instead. If you're old enough, you'll remember when Made in USA meant built to last, and Made in Japan meant cheap junk. A couple of decades later, Made in USA meant unreliable, and Made in Japan meant the gold standard of quality. Fast forward to today. Nothing is made in America except credit default swaps, and toxic derivatives, and war machines. And Japan is outsourcing its own manufacturing to China, too. Did we take a vote on all this? Was there a referendum I missed? Somebody decided to de-industrialize the United States, to turn the country into the world's largest third-world debtor nation. I'm sure we've overtaken Brazil by now. Somebody decided to make America's poor poorer, to destroy the working class, and last, to destroy the middle class as well. Somebody decided to transform all that national wealth into higher corporate profits and greater personal wealth for the few who are already very rich. When was the referendum? When was the vote? Maybe I missed it from not watching television. You'd think there would have been at least a few robocalls.
Hi, this is Dave Rockefeller, urging you to vote yes this Tuesday on deindustrialization. It's time America grew up and joined the third world. This message sponsored by the Chase Manhattan Bank and Walmart.
Two brief notes, and then I'll yield the microphone to Marie Lausch. A couple decades ago, before Walmart had metastasized into the stage 4 cancer it has become, Here's how they won the hearts and minds of too many of the American people. I remember seeing this myself. They hung big American flags on the walls and hung big banners proclaiming, "Whenever possible, Walmart stocks products made in USA." It was a lie even back then, but it worked. The lie became a sick joke as the ever-growing retailer squeezed its suppliers for every penny, thus forcing suppliers to turn to China and other impoverished third world countries to manufacture the goods they would supply to Walmart. Just a few years back, the American media went through a stint of glorifying corporate CEOs. A large percentage of this glory was heaped upon one Jack Welch, CEO of Connecticut's own General Electric Corporation. Welch received all this glory, laud, and praise because General Electric was reporting record profits. In true American fashion, the capitalist heroes at GE made these huge profits by the time-honored techniques of financial speculation by the corporation's financial arm, by grossly inflating the list price for all the military hardware they sold to the government, and by closing down American factories left and right, and shifting as much production as possible to Mexico and overseas. Not only GE proper, Welch strongly urged all of the company's suppliers to shift their production abroad, too. What a hero! Welch may be gone from the marbled halls of GE headquarters, or whatever their blankety-blank halls are made of, but his ghost remains. Here's a recent story about GE, told by Marie Lausch. She is president of the Connecticut statewide United Electrical Workers Union. She spoke at the University of Connecticut on November 14 in a symposium on converting Connecticut to a peace economy. You will see that Lausch is not what you would call a spellbinding orator. But though she's a little weak in the fifth part of rhetoric, pronunciatio, the words she was saying captured the audience's attention, hearts, and minds. Here's roughly the second half of her talk.
In a country that cannot even provide universal health care for her citizens, our corporate welfare system flourishes, not only in the recently publicized bank bailouts, but also on a daily basis. Profits trump peace every time. What other industry besides defense has guaranteed sales to a single customer even when the costs are bloated or run well over the projected deadlines? Lax oversight and poor accountability adds to our tax bills, while many corporations make the most of tax incentives fleeing overseas. What could be done if we made our politicians stop listening to the buck and start listening to the people? If we maintained a defensive and not an offensive military? These war dollars could be diverted to education, healthcare, transportation, fixing our crumbling bridges and roads, and rebuilding our infrastructure. We could fund thousands of jobs where workers could be retrained and manufacturers retooled. I have no delusions that this task would be easy. It'd be resisted every step of the way by those that profit most. In any business geared toward military manufacturing, a good part of that payroll goes toward internal security. Could production increase without these constraints? I think so. Would it matter to most American workers whether they made windmills or war machines? Not if the wages were comparable. No doubt today we'll have discussion on green jobs coming into Connecticut. I have a cautionary tale to tell you today. As the old saying goes, be careful what you ask for. We must be vigilant of how corporate globalization and neoliberalism drive our policies and laws. For the last several years, General Electric has been restructuring their lighting business. 15 plants that make incandescent light bulbs closed in the U.S. alone. Over 3,000 jobs lost, with similar closings in Brazil, Mexico, Canada, and other GE locations around the world. My union, specifically UE 731 in Conneaut, Ohio, lost their jobs. They were told by the company that they could provide alternate ideas to the plant closing. Everybody knew that was a bunch of guff. They weren't going to listen. The incandescent bulbs manufactured since Thomas Edison's time in these plants are being outlawed by 2014 as being non-energy efficient. One of our workers was quoted as saying, "The government did us in." Yet who was one of the prime lobbyists for the phasing out of these bulbs? GE itself. Now, why would a manufacturer lobby to close down its own business, you might ask? GE is doing a tremendous business in a joint venture with Xiamen Topstar Lighting in China, manufacturing compact fluorescent lamps, CFLs. When a GE official was asked why the U.S. factories could not be retooled to manufacture fluorescent bulbs here, he stated, "The cost would not have been justified." GE's dirty little secret is that their cost is foisted off on the health and well-being of workers in China. Laborers in Xiamen Topstar, in violation of Chinese labor and environmental laws, as well as in violation of GE's corporate policy, operate in a climate that would not be tolerated here. Besides the low wages, employees typically work a 64-hour week with little or no overtime and are given no pay stubs, so they can't tell if they're being paid properly or not. Most of the workers are female, and no one over age 32 is ever hired. If an employee is late half an hour, they're fined a day's wage. More heinous than that is the fact that these workers are not told they're working with mercury, what precautions to take, nor are they told the symptoms of mercury poisoning. A London newspaper reports that a large number of workers in the plant suffer from mercury poisoning. Let's bring this back home and understand that the EPA provided special exemptions so that these mercury-containing light bulbs could be sold in the U.S. Have you read the precautions you should take in your home if one of these required bulbs breaks? There's about 10 steps that you need to do to keep your family safe. What will their disposal do to our landfills in a few years? Again, I say that we need good, green jobs here, but must cast a wary eye at large corporations and the politicians financed by them. I do not have all the solutions, my friends. I do know what American workers want, and that is a decent job in a safe workplace for a fair wage. I'm willing to learn and work with you in obtaining these goals. I know that we need to change our mindset and do what is best for this great country of ours. We need to take on the most difficult job that a modern America can, the job of waging peace. Thank you.
Did you know that incandescent light bulbs were going to be verboten by 2014? This was news to me until I heard Lausch say it. Replaced with mercury-filled fluorescent bulbs, which save a little electricity and will drastically pollute our landfills and our homes, to say nothing of the Chinese factories and the Chinese workers and the Chinese landfills and homes, with highly toxic mercury. Let's have a song by Anne Feeney. Please don't think of this as a Christmas song played a month too late. Think of it instead as a labor song played about 30 years too late.
Put down those hammers, put down those saws. You ain't working no more for Santa Claus. Turn in the bells, grab a pink slip. You elves have been replaced by a microchip. Now Frosty the Snowman, you've been outsourced. No more meltdowns on our workforce. Additionally, these layoffs shall include the sugar plum fairy and that nutcracker dude. Christmas has a brand new CEO, and the business plan don't include any ho ho ho. A new holiday for a brand new century. We're gonna package Christmas and make it work efficiently. Total restructure began today of this much overrated holiday. Downsize, streamline, the experts say, why Christmas ain't nothing but a dead giveaway. The homeland chimney security, why why Santa's been taken into custody. In the race to the bottom, you're taking the lead. There's no holiday for corporate greed. Power bills rising clean out of sight. Gonna euthanize that reindeer with the bright red light. Unplug the manger, unplug the tree. We're switching to fluorescents and LEDs. Furthermore, our studies did conclude that factories aren't suited to this latitude. To fight the cost of heating in so much snow, we're moving these jobs to Mexico. Christmas.
Let's hear more from Ellen Ruppel Shell. Here's a passage from her book Cheap, reprinted in the Toronto Globe and Mail, and then condensed for radio by me. With its irreverent television commercials and conspicuously progressive outlook, IKEA appears to be the anti-Walmart, a high-minded company where value and good values coexist. Image may not be everything, but sometimes it's enough. Big box discounters like Walmart scour the globe for low-priced suppliers of their low-priced goods. IKEA takes matters one step further. It designs to price, commissioning its suppliers to build not a kitchen table and two chairs, but a custom-designed kitchen table and two chairs to sell for $100. Every year, IKEA challenges its suppliers to lower their prices, and every year it challenges its designers to dream up still cheaper objects to sell. IKEA is the third largest consumer of wood in the world, just behind Home Depot and Lowe's, and ahead of Walmart. The timber used in the wood products sold by these chains comes mostly from Eastern Europe and the Russian Far East, where wages are low, large wooded regions remote, and, according to the World Bank, half of all logging is illegal. Forests in this region are in decline, especially forests of high-demand varieties like oak, ash, birch, and Korean pine. In pursuit of these and other valuable species, illegal loggers cut on restricted riverbanks, fish spawning sites, and other conservation areas, and bribe officials to falsify certificates. Most of this wood goes to make cheap tables, chairs, bookcases, and other wood products sold by discounters, especially in the United States. Environmentalists warn that the demand for cheap Chinese-made furniture has stoked a cut-and-consume cycle that is destroying the world's forests at a rate unprecedented in human history. This harvest is not sustainable, and what's being taken is not renewable. Illegal logging operations are generally in remote areas that are difficult to oversee, including wildlife habitat and conservation land. Over the long haul, Deforestation contributes mightily to climate change, accounting for over 18% of global carbon dioxide emissions, more than the entire global transport system or the whole of the industrial manufacturing sectors. Many of us think of IKEA as the world's largest furniture maker, but that's wrong. It's the world's largest furniture retailer. Its products are hammered out by tens of thousands of workers, mostly employed by other companies. 1,300 vendors in 52 countries. China is IKEA's largest supplier, but if Chinese workers demand better wages, protections, and benefits, as they have in the past, IKEA is likely to move on to India or Vietnam, where the company already has a strong foothold. Maria Vinka designs fabrics, cutlery, clocks, china, and furniture for IKEA. Her proudest creation is a stackable rocking chair composed primarily of tightly woven banana leaf fibers, the Gullholmen. Vinka's chair is made in Vietnam in a vast open factory. Women weave the banana fibers and men weld the frames. Each chair takes half a day to build and in the United States costs $59.99. Vietnamese enforcement of environmental and human rights regulations is at best haphazard. Factories there pay workers as little as $50 a month for a 48-hour, 6-day work week. As one American commentator said about doing business in Vietnam, quote, "They are bringing into the global labor pool hundreds of millions of low-wage workers, people whose wages are held in check by both capital mobility and communist repression. The effect of this is to hold down wages in democratic developed nations." IKEA succeeds the way all discounters do, by passing much of its costs on to us. The chain has a policy of having relatively few stores, 270 spread across 35 countries and territories. Most are enormous. Atlanta's IKEA is the size of 7 football fields. Like discount outlet malls, IKEA stores are positioned well outside city centers, a cost savings to the company. But now consumers must drive very long distances, an average 50-mile round trip in the United States. Consumers must also drive back to the store to return malfunctioning furniture or retrieve missing parts, a surprisingly frequent occurrence. As a result, gnarly traffic jams often surround IKEA stores. On weekends, lines of idling cars can back up for miles. IKEA touts its green side by lighting its stores with low-wattage bulbs and charging extra for plastic bags, while its clientele burns through gallon after gallon of fuel to buy disposable tables and lamps. Wig Zamor, an urban development expert trained at MIT, put it this way, "IKEA is the least sustainable retailer on the planet." Okay, now this is me speaking. In sum, there are strong connections among ubiquitous junk merchandise, domestic unemployment and poverty, starvation wages abroad, pollution everywhere, the destruction of the environment, the deindustrialization and third worldization of America, and the ever-increasing wealth of the already rich. Sorry, Andy, that's the broader picture. Thank you, dear listener, for your thoughtful attention. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, provided rent-free by that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are my own. Of course, that doesn't make them wrong. Illigit of my non-carborundum, please tune in again, and ciao.